Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Look, thanks for coming along tonight. I know we had a late notice, we put Christopher Hill on at lunchtime, so it looks like fun's been going all day here. So it's great to have Susan Mitchell back. I think she last spoke here at the, on the occasion of your book on Margaret Whitlam, which was very successful. And on this occasion, Susan's talking about Stand By Your Man, which is the wives of the recent Liberal Prime Ministers, Sonny McMahon, Tammy Fraser and Jeanette Howard. Susan Mitchell, of course, is a well-known author and broadcaster, educated at the University of Adelaide, Flinders University, written a number of books, presented TV programs such as Four Poppies and Susan Mitchell in Conversation, and here today to talk about Stand By Your Man, Sonia, Tammy and Jeanette, and Janet Grundy's got copies of that down the back. Susan Mitchell, you're welcome.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Anne. Thank you all for coming tonight. A lot of people have asked me why I wanted to write this book, and it did come about as a result of having done the biography on Margaret Whitlam, because I think this pointed out to me, and if you think about it, there's a huge gap in our historical knowledge and our political knowledge of our Prime Minister's wives. I mean, Cherie Blair's written her own stuff, but there are loads of biographies about her. Certainly Hillary Clinton, you could fill a library already, she's not even president yet. And then of course going way back to Eleanor Roosevelt, etc. So why is it that when I wrote Margaret's biography, it was the first long, serious biography of a prime ministerial wife, certainly since the war? And I thought, well, what is it about these women? Do we think that they're not worthy of being written about? Do they play such a small role in our lives? Or is it that in fact they're just all boring? I mean, maybe they're just so keen to stand by their men and smile and do nothing really, like children, that
do you want me to talk about that?
Okay.
That we're not terribly interested. We assume that there's nothing there. Certainly we don't think there's very much political power there, which is I think why the press gallery, which let's face it, has always been largely male, has never been interested in them in terms of interviews or political analysis, because they never assumed that they had any political power, not even really very much political influence. So I was talking to my agent about what I'd do next, and he said, well, you know, if this is a gap, why don't you try and fill it? And I thought, well, yeah, that's a good idea. And so I said, well, who are you interested in? I said, I think I should do some women on the other side of politics. She said, well, who? And I said, oh, I've always been interested in Sonia, Tammy and Jeanette. And then I laughed because they sounded like a country and western trio. Hence the little motifs of the book, and the little motifs of boots in the book throughout. And then we said, oh, we could call it Stand By Your Man, laughed again. But in fact, of course, it turned out to be that. I have to be honest, didn't know very much about any of them. Sonia McMahon, I would have said to you, yes, well, she's best known for wearing a white dress with slits up the sides of the Nixon White House. You know, it caused a big sensation. But really, I don't know much more about her than that. And probably I suspect that's true for most of you, unless you're personal friends of Sonia. Although even her personal friends to whom I spoke said she's an immensely private woman, and they read things in this book that they've never known, and they've known it for 40 years. So I thought, I wonder if she's aware of the fact that this is all she's thought of, and then I really seriously wondered whether she was more than just up a glamour adornment, a beautiful appendage on the arm of Billy McMahon, because he decided Menzies told him you'll never be Prime Minister unless you get a wife. And so he selected a very young, glamorous wife. The suggestion of this, I think, upset Sonia because she is very definite about the fact that she was in love with Billy when she married him and she believed that he was with her. So I had a whole lot of questions about getting to the bottom of Sonia McMahon and working out exactly, you know, what the nature of the relationship was and just how much political power she had. It's very interesting because I found a wonderful woman called Pat Wheatley in the Southern Highlands. She wasn't just wandering the streets. I did actually... This book is sort of part investigative journalism and part biography. So I actually take you with me when I'm undergoing these investigations and find people. Pat Wheatley was Billy McMahon's private secretary for a very, very long time. And she was there when he first asked Sonia out. She was there through the marriage and then through the birth of all the children. So she had pretty good vision of what was going on. And the brilliant thing about women of Pat's age and Sonia and Tammy, they're in their mid-70s. It's sort of like, oh, what the hell, I might as well tell the truth now anyway. So it's a fantastic time for a writer to actually get to them. 20 years earlier, they probably wouldn't have told me the things they told me. Pat says she remembers the day when Menzies actually announced his retirement. And the first thing Billy did was go to the phone book and look up Sonia Hopkins, which was her name, and ask her out to dinner. Now, Sonia Hopkins had come back from overseas, where she'd been sort of drifting around doing various jobs. She'd had an affair with a film producer and that had ended, so she'd come back. She'd met Billy briefly at a charity, you know, money-raising function. And she said, oh, you know, she didn't really think much about it. He said he'd give her a ring. She wasn't really hanging out for it because she'd already taken up with an old boyfriend. Anyway, so Billy asked her out to dinner, and in that year, he was engaged to her. By December, they were walking down the aisle at St. Mark's. They were having the reception in the Sydney Golf Club. And by January, their honeymoon was shortened because, of course, we know that Menzies resigned, and just as Billy predicted, Holt went into that position, and Billy became Treasurer of Australia. But he had a glamorous wife by his side, which I'm sure he thought would improve his image, and I'm sure it probably did in many respects. That is not to say that it wasn't a genuine love relationship. And we all know about all those insinuations about Billy. You know, any man in that period who was 59 and unmarried had certain question marks above his head. You know, why hadn't he married? What was wrong with him? Was he some kind of closet homosexual? Was he having affairs on the side? I mean, all of these things. So I asked a lot of people about this issue. And certainly Pat Wheatley said, well, she was with him for a very, very long time. She knew the women that he was having affairs with. It was also one of those women who had a kind of filing system. He took certain women to certain events and certain ones to others, depending upon who was appropriate for being on his arm at the time. She said she never had any evidence at all that he ever engaged in any activity, sexual activities with men. There was never a clue. And you would think over all that period there'd be a letter or a note or something, you know, a spangle drop somewhere, but nothing. So I think I have to assume that even if there were inclinations in that direction, he never did anything about it, and he certainly did have affairs with women. Also, he had, as we all remember, he was small. The caricaturists always had him scuttling across the floor of Parliament House. He had a very fast walk. He had big ears. He was deaf, which had quite a sort of high-pitched voice as well. So this probably all engendered this kind of image. So there's glamorous young Sonia Hopkins married on the arm of Billy McMahon. And I'm sure everybody thought, well, he's just done this because he wanted to be Prime Minister. Now, there's no denying that she was a great asset, I'm sure, in that goal. But nevertheless, what I uncovered was the fact that she, prior to this, hadn't really been very interested in politics. She was more interested in the party than the liberal side of it. She handed out a few how-to-vote cards before she'd gone overseas, but it was really the social activities. She had a really scarring experience very early in her youth, given that she'd sort of had a traditional upbringing, met the first boyfriend, fallen in love, she was about to marry him, and she was literally jilted at the altar when she was very young. The wedding presents had already started to arrive at the house, and this bloke turned up and said he had cold feet and he couldn't go through with it. So I think that meant that she was pretty distrustful of men after that, and certainly allowing herself to give her heart to anybody. I think she was indeed broken-hearted. So I think she didn't have those problems with Billy. I think she thought he's genuinely committed to this, but she also knew he was genuinely committed to politics, that he was passionate about it. So he taught her everything that he knew, all his years. He schooled her in politics, and much to her surprise, she found it to be very interesting. Not that she ever let on that she knew this. Not that she allowed everybody to think that she was a kind of beautiful Barbie doll on his arm and she didn't really know very much about politics. He, in fact, took her everywhere with him. She had a big choice to make. She had young children, or she could go with her new husband all around the world to these meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Otherwise, she would never see him. She chose to go with her husband. She had a nanny to look after the children, and she went everywhere with him. She knew how to read a budget. He schooled her on who was who, and so she developed this technique of a spy, really. She worked out with very powerful and important men, exchanged the best information at morning tea. Not at the meetings, but at morning tea. So she'd get a cup of coffee and she would slide around the room. They wouldn't have looked past the hairspray or perhaps noted the legs or whatever. She heard all this information and then she took it back to Billy. And I have to say that I did ask, and I did check up on this, that Australia actually did better in their borrowing capacity during that stage because of Sonia's morning tea salties. Because Billy knew what information had been passed. The other thing was that I think gradually he began to depend more and more and more on her. So by the time he was running for election, she was writing his speeches. She was his spin doctor. She was his political advisor. She was his political strategist. And in fact, I don't think he ever made a political decision that he didn't run past her. So the image of this woman that she used, she never made any political statements. If anybody asked her a political question, she would deflect it. And so she had this disguise. The glamour was used to disguise the political influence and the political knowledge that that she gained from Billy, and then she gained from having been with him, really, day and night. So that was the first thing, to go behind the scenes and gradually peel away the public image and see the real person behind this. I think she was a bit hurt. I rang her up after the book came out, and she was a bit hurt, not by anything that I had to say about her, but because I think she thought that somewhere along the way I should have said that Billy McMahon was the best treasurer and the best prime minister that Australia ever had. And I explained to her that I actually had to report what other people had said, and that I hadn't read that anywhere. But that, you know, and I understood that she wanted to keep his legacy alive. And it's, you know, often we know this, when people die, their husbands and wives turn into saints, don't they? So when I asked her, you know, well, what about Billy's failings? She said, I don't really want to go there. I don't want to bridge that up. So I thought, fair enough. So that's the reason that I think if she's got any misgivings, it's probably that. Okay, so the irony is, of course, that there's Sonia McMahon, you know, baby doll, beautiful, on the arm of this ageing Prime Minister, and everybody thinks that she knows nothing. The first Prime Minister's wife, well, got with and won that election, so up looms Margaret, literally, all right? An entirely different kettle of fish. The irony is that Margaret was outspoken. I mean, Margaret, if you ask Margaret a question, Margaret would give you an answer. She used to say, ask me an outrageous question, I'll give you an outrageous answer. And she did. And she wasn't afraid to say, yes, she believed in legal abortion because she'd been a social worker and she'd seen too many backyard abortions, you know, and the destructive power of them. Yes, she thought that they should legalise marijuana. Now, she never saw herself as a spokesperson for the Labor Party or indeed her husband. She was just Margaret Whitlam and she was giving her opinion. You know, she really wasn't all that fascinated by politics or its machinations or its cut and thrust. If she'd married a lawyer, she would have been interested in law in the same way, but it wouldn't have been the only game in town for her. So the irony is that I think she had practically no political influence on the Prime Minister. I don't know that anybody else did, really. He spent quite a long time working out what he was going to do when he got power. You know, 23 years is a long time for a party to be out of government. But certainly Margaret would never have taken any notice of Margaret, because he would have considered that Margaret's job was to bring up the children and facilitate the life, but certainly not to give political advice to him. Nor did she ever try, because she wasn't all that interested. So it's a lovely irony there, where Margaret really broke the mould of Prime Minister's wife by being outspoken and not being prepared just to stand by a man and smile, and, you know, she actually had a go, but it really didn't, I don't think it had any political influence on the Prime Minister. So then, of course, we come to the dismissal, and we come to Tammy. And Tammy Fraser is an entirely different personality, certainly to either Margaret or to Sonia. She said she was practically cradle snatched when Martha married her. She was so young, she'd never worked. She finished boarding school and went home back to her family's property in the Western Districts. And she just sort of helped out and did a bit of charity work. And then she married Malcolm, who at the time was a politician. And she says she remembers seeing a photo of him and thinking that he was quite dishy, but then thinking, why would someone who looked like that go into politics? So she had no interest in politics at all, and certainly didn't regard it very highly. But of course, given that Malcolm was in it, and he was very ambitious and very keen to get on, she too engaged in a learning process, but she too adopted a disguise. She never let on that in fact she was engaged in very close consultation with her husband, and is certainly involved in all his major political decisions. She adopted the sort of giggly, bubbly, I mean, she's got that sort of a personality on the surface. There's a steely strength in Tammy that I think she doesn't show very often. She was always losing her contact lens and having people down on the floor looking for them and making silly little gaffes and saying, oh, silly me, none of which meant that anybody took Tammy very seriously other than as, quote, a good wife. And they said, well, you know, Malcolm can't be all that bad if Tammy sticks with him. So he sort of treated her as somebody who was very good for his career in that sense, and that's what people thought. She allowed this to happen. If they asked her any political questions, she'd say, oh, that's boring, I don't want to talk about it. I'm not interested in discussing politics. And when I said to her, well, why did you say that? And she said, well, to deflect them away, of course, from the fact that I was very much engaged in every political decision. She said, I might have been serving the coffee at 3 a.m, but I wasn't in bed asleep. I was up there sitting with them, talking, engaged in it, giving my opinion. And I'm sure she was always the one person Malcolm trusted, and also the one person that he finally discussed everything with. She was part of all the plan in terms of the, you know, blocking supply and the dismissal, the whole thing. She was right in there. Not that anyone ever suspected it for a minute. And she was actually didn't like the media at all. She said she used to be vile to them. She'd just say yes or no, and if they didn't want to talk about the children or the family, she wasn't going to engage with them at all. And this was, she said, well, that's because I didn't want them to know about power. I didn't want them to think that I was interfering. So we come to this problem, I think, of unelected power and our relationship with it. Are we happy that the wife of the Prime Minister has that amount of political power? Because we have elected the Prime Minister and not the wife. Are we happy that they've disguised the level of their political influence? Should they be more like Hillary Clinton, who was quite open and honest to the American people about the fact that she and Bill were a total team, and that Bill said, when you elect me, you get two for the price of one. She got a bit of flack over that initially, but people knew that she meant it, and what's more, she became an operative. I mean, certainly she made a stuff up of the whole thing, but look, it can't have damaged her too much. She's running for president. So right from the beginning, we knew about her political influence. Right, so Tammy, of course, did let her guard down a couple of times. Remember that time when there was a rumour going around that Malcolm had cancer, and he put out a press release saying it wasn't true, and Richard Carlton had rung up and invited him on the show, and he said no. Then he'd rung Tammy, and Tammy had said no. And then later in the afternoon, she decided, well, you know, blow this, I'm going to go in. And so it was live television. Richard Carlton had just started. She stormed into the studio, said, I'm here to tell you that he does not have cancer, and I wish you'd stop even talking about his health. He's perfectly well. I spent all afternoon engaging in phone calls with my children and my family and friends and everybody worried about him. He's perfectly healthy. And Richard Carlton was sort of, you know, I mean, this is live television, totally dumbstruck by this woman who'd swept in her dinner clothes. And he said, well, how is he? He didn't know what to say. He said, well, how is he really? She said, I've just finished telling you that, and I'm going now, and I'm going off to dinner. Malcolm was in another room, you know, sitting there waiting for Tammy to pick him up. So that, in fact, displayed the kind of real strength and the real power of that woman. She would do it if her family was threatened. She would reveal exactly the metal of which she was made, but at other times you would just get this giggly, gaffy sort of, you know, person who was, oh no, I'm not really interested in politics. Now we come to Jeanette Howard, right? Totally different again. Jeanette Howard is very, very interesting, partly because she's such a mystery and such an enigma. She didn't speak to me. I made three separate attempts to speak with her. And eventually Tony O'Leary, who's the Prime Minister's personal advisor, rang me and said, look, she's not going to do this interview, Susan. It's nothing personal. She just doesn't do very many interviews. And I said, no, I realise that. So then I had to engage in more journalistic investigation. And I spoke to people on and off the record. I spoke to a lot of deep throats. And you will come with me as I piece together this information. And the picture that emerges from all of this is that Jeanette Howard is a truly political animal. She has hidden this from the Australian people. Certainly since John was, her husband was elected Prime Minister. In the early days, she was much more willing to engage with journalists. Laurie Oakes says he remembers her at Liberal Party retreats, and John would go to bed and Jeanette would be up until the late hours of the morning arguing the toss, talking politics, eyes on fire. She loved every single minute of the political discussion, and so she'd be there standing at the bar with the journalists, and he said he remembers how perceptive and how bright and how incisive she was about politics. So we have this picture of, on the one hand, and I've never seen evidence of this person. You know those pictures, of early pictures of Jeanette, where she's in mini skirts and boots and long hair, and evidently she drove a black sports car, which is, you know, very cool for the 1960s, I have to say. However, she was not part of that movement in the 1960s. And I was at university in the 1960s where, you know, we were all against the war in Vietnam and marching and then led into feminism and, you know, basically having a fantastic time being protesters. And this was a worldwide movement. She was a conservative, even at that stage. And she was a member of the Liberal Party. She met John on Valentine's Day, but it was not love of which they spoke. It was politics. And he realised that he was somebody who was as excited and committed obsessed in a way with politics as he was. She was an only child, therefore, and I know this because I'm an only child, used to being listened to, used to having people, because you never had any sibling rivalry, you always had your parents' attention. And he was a man who actually listened to her, took her political views into account, and together she said she realised very early on that he had the kind of no-quitting resilience that would probably take him to be Prime Minister, and that's where he wanted to go. And what's more, he wanted to take her with him. So there they are, the Bill and Hillary of Australia, a team. If you vote for John, you get two for the price of one. However, unlike Hillary, Jeanette was not prepared to come out in the open and tell us this. What is the evidence? Well, the image, of course, changed, and she kind of slipped into the shadows. And you see this rather matronly figure in beige or pastel suits, smiling a lot, but never giving interviews, never really talking about her political conviction or her political passions. Giving the imagery that she's quite happy just to stay at home and look after the children in the house and wait for John to come home on weekends, and that was her major activity. In fact, the one person who did manage, that I did talk to, Christine Hogan, who did an interview with her prior to the 96 election, did manage to get inside the Wollstonecraft house, was amazed, was stunned at the fact that this was not a house that had been run by somebody who was in love with housework and tidying and polishing and cleaning. Not that I want to say there's anything wrong with this, because I had housework too, but it was not the house of someone who spent their life making the home beautiful. She said the dining room had seen better days, probably had looked as if it hadn't been polished for 10 years. There were piles of stuff in the corner, kids' stuff everywhere, the whole place was a mess. And when Jeanette left the room for a short while, Christine Hogan looked under the couch and she saw two huge balls of dust. She said, which she knew meant that the place hadn't been dusted. Anyone who was into housework knew that the place hadn't been dusted for a very long time. So the question is, okay, well, if she's not doing that, what is she doing? Well, I think it's quite obvious now, because the Prime Minister's even admitted it. She's his main media monitor. She was monitoring the media. She was following her passion. She was leading a surrogate political life. Sure, when the kids came home, she was there and she was doing all these things, but her real passion was being followed. And so I think she's made the decision that she will create a different kind of disguise from the others, slip into the shadows, but I don't think anybody in the Prime Minister's department is in any doubt about her power and about the fact that she is someone with her, in whom he totally trusts, whose political policy skills, political decision making is something upon which he totally relies. And because, you know, when she rings up, which evidently she does very often, they say Hyacinth on the phone. And I don't know whether any of you have seen Hyacinth Bouquet or Hyacinth Bucket, as her name really is. But that is her, you know, pseudonym. And Hyacinth, unlike Jeanette Key, Hyacinth was very keen on dusting. But she was also the power. She was the power. So this is in fact the image that has emerged. I'm sorry that she didn't talk to me, because I would like to have judged these things for myself. Not that I think she would necessarily have told me all of those things, because she's very good at deflecting those questions. But I did do a lot of research, and those journalists like Craig McGregor, who had interviewed her at various stages, say that her eyes just light up when one of the Prime Minister's advisers would walk into the room and she'd say, how's the budget going? Or ask a totally political question, she was right into it. Makes sense, doesn't it? She was very bright. She went to a selective school in Sydney. There was no chance of her ever getting to be Prime Minister in the 60s, even if she wanted to be. Let's face it, there's no chance of anyone at the moment looking as if they're a woman as if they're going to be Prime Minister of this country. I don't know what they're putting in the water in New Zealand, but they've managed to get someone up there. And we're nowhere near it on either side of politics, I don't think. So she did what women of that generation did. They married the man they wanted to become. So if you were a nurse, you really had always wanted to be a doctor, you married a doctor. These days, of course, you say to your daughter, if you want to be a doctor, enroll in medicine. Marry a doctor if you want to, but not as a kind of surrogate career for yourself. So I think that this is the image, which is why these women, in conclusion, these women have done so much more than stand by their men. They've certainly done that in spades, as Tammy would say. And yes, speaking of Tammy, I did talk about the trouser incident in Memphis, not because I wanted to dredge up anything smutty, but because it went actually to the core of that woman and to how she dealt with it. And that tells you more about Tammy, I think, than anything else. When, after it had all come out in the Australian media, and I think Malcolm just wanted to bury himself, months and not talk to anybody and hope that it would all go away, she insisted that they go to the Melbourne Cup. And this was like 2 weeks after it had splashed across all the papers. And he was reluctant. She said, no, we're going. So of course they arrive and the crowds are there and they see Malcolm and they start singing Memphis, Tennessee and like, calling out, good on your Mal, you know, never thought you had it in your mouth. in that kind of classic Australian fashion that we've got, and Malcolm was evidently just, you know, dying, and Tammy was brilliant. You see, Tammy called back, no, I didn't know it either, and smiled and laughed and cheered and made Malcolm wave, and so what a brilliant way to deal with it. And that actually is, she is a fantastic political tactician or spin doctor. No PR firm could have handled that better in terms of her. She didn't have to go on television like Hillary Clinton and be exposed to Tammy Wynette's Standing By Your Man song. So there we have it. That's why it's called Stand By Your Man. I predicted that it would be, but I didn't think that I would discover what I did discover, what I did uncover in this journey. So thank you very much for listening to me. Do you have any questions?
That's time is brilliant. So Janet currently down the back's got copies of Stand By Your Man. So we come to questions and discussion. I learned a lot, but I'm particularly, if you're going to ask anyone around, don't ask Christine Hogan. Particularly if you've got dust under the couch. So you think, I mean, there was a friend of mine who used to work with Billy McMahon, and he said, I did arrange the marriage, he said, but I didn't father the children. I mean, you think it was a genuine love match between Sonia and...
Yeah, I do. I do think it was a genuine love match. And here on page 36, it was actually Pat Wheatley, who, as I said, who'd been his secretary, who lived through the courtship, the marriage and the birth of children. She said she was perfect wife material, and it was a good political move if Billy wanted to be Prime Minister, which of course he did. But Billy loved her, no doubt about that. He adored her. They were terribly close, and he discussed all things political with her. She was certainly not just a woman in a white dress with slits to the thighs. She was the best thing ever to have happened to him, and I knew she would have stuck by him no matter what. It was great to see that he finally had someone to lean on and to love him the way she did. She was fun-loving, but she took the marriage very seriously.
I should say, thanks to Cause for the specific in the rough hand.
Did you consider as you were doing it that one of the reasons why these three women, and even Margaret Whitlam didn't do it very successfully and was forced to go back in, took the position they did because politically it's not advantageous to the Prime Minister if your wife looks like their political figure? I mean, Janet Howard has thrown at her, she's the main lady behind. And when Margaret Whitlam did open her mouth, she was regarded as having, you know, got in the way of the Labor Party, you know, success. So what's in the culture? See, to me, the only person, the only wife of any Prime Minister that's done it successfully was Linda Mines.
Yes.
Who not only
she did.
Went on later, but right from the time he was Premier of Tasmania, she was literally told by him to go out and make political speeches.
She was.
And she did. But all the others adopted this role, and some of them even totally stayed away from Canada, like Mrs. Chifley and Mrs. Scullin. So is it because of our culture?
And Mrs. Good.
Yeah, and this is like...
And Mrs. Howard.
Different from New Zealand. We have got this aversion to the consort, particularly the female, being in the limelight when that's not their job.
Yes, well, it may well be. It may well be why we have so few names we can state when we talk about.
Did you ask them that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I think they were aware. All they said was, I wasn't elected, and I don't think that people wanted to know about me necessarily in those terms. What they didn't say, and I think what is true, is that they were worried that it would deflect from their husband's power and their husband's image. I don't think Margaret was ever worried about hers deflecting Guy's.
But
it was used against him, but she didn't care, and neither did he. I don't think he did. I mean, I think she got upset, but it wasn't going to stop her, you know. I mean, she was going to go on being Margaret for the rest of the time. But, you know, I do think that Jeanette Howard would worry that certainly it would disempower John if people knew the extent to which she was Hillary to his Bill Clinton, and certainly Tammy, I think. So there is that, but I think, you know, we have to evolve, don't we? We have to, and I would much rather that Jeanette had come clean and been like Hillary and said, look, we're a team, you know, we're both interested. See, that's why Margaret didn't understand. When John was eventually elected leader again after all that time, Margaret saw Jeanette somewhere and she said, oh, congratulations, or should I say commiserations. And she said Jeanette visibly bridled at this and said, why would you say commiserations when we've got exactly what we've always wanted? And I thought, hello, bad hair day or something, you know. And I said, you didn't understand that in fact, you know, it was as important to Jeanette as it was to John, and that the two of them, you know. And I said, Margaret, she says politics is the only game in town. She said, really? How boring is that? So, you know, she's entirely different, but for Jeanette, it is the only game in town. And so perhaps she doesn't want to reveal that, but I think we all would like to have known that. And I don't see anything wrong with that, you know. I think it's time we left behind that old, you know, she's so bright and he's not.
Well, do you think it's possible?
Pardon? Well, I think ironically, probably Therese has sort of done her stint of following her man around. I mean, he was a diplomat, she followed him around, she had the children, she didn't have a job. And then she got the job and she's built up. The first time we've got a woman who's, you know, has her own, not only her own career, but has a multi-million-dollar empire to run. So I think that she'll make appearances when she thinks it's important, but I don't think she'd say, I don't want to go onto his turf. I mean, that's his game. It's not mine. I've got other things to do. So she'll be like a modern woman, juggling, you know, family, husband, and her own career. Yes.
I'll run this.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Otherwise, I'll just take over. You take it. There are some questions.
I have a question to be addressed to the speaker as well as to Mr. Henderson.
I told him to get out of control.
Oh, but it's so much more interesting.
I mean, Dr. Henderson has been in the political scene and has been associated with at least one Prime Minister. What is his experience, and have you interviewed him? What is his experience with the wives of the different politicians?
I think you should answer this. Well, one of my dearest friends are Prime Minister's wives, but I've never married one of them.
Right. I think you have to know that he's one of my dear friends.
Yes,
you were. I interviewed Anne formally, but I interviewed you informally. You probably didn't realise you were being interviewed.
I didn't say anything. Well, that's true. Well,
Would any of the wives actually go beyond their husbands and contact a politician, say a minister, directly to influence them?
Well, I think they'd be a lot more subtle than that, because I think that'd be too obvious. But certainly, evidently, Tammy did do a bit of influence in terms of whaling, the killing of whales. She claims now it was really Phoebe who talked her husband into it. But people do credit her with having worked on Malcolm. But she would work on Malcolm, not on the bureaucrat or the other minister. But and I think that Jeanette Howard did let her guard down once, and that was when Glenn Milne said in one of his columns that he got it from a cabinet minister that Jeanette had actually nominated Archbishop Hollingworth at the time for Governor General, and she went feral. She immediately rang the Prime Minister's department, pulled her husband out of a cabinet meeting, and they said they could hear the shouting and the how dare he say this, and, you know, what are you going to do about it? And so, of course, what happened was that he went back in and he talked to cabinet, and they wrote a letter for her on her behalf saying it wasn't true. She put herself right out on the limb. She demanded a public apology from Glenn Milne, which he refused to give. So she was left with egg on her face, and those of us who know Shakespeare thought perhaps the lady does protest too much.
I suspect she's telling the truth. Yeah.
Susan, given your characterisation of Jeanette Howard, is it fair to say she's really best seen as the power behind the throne? And given your comment about what she said when they finally achieved what they'd always wanted, how much of the perceived intransigence of the Prime Minister to hold on to his office can be attributed to her stay as First Lady?
Well, you know that well-known socialist newspaper, the Daily Telegraph in Sydney, actually stated that, you know, when he was going to deciding whether to hand over to the Treasurer or to hang on this time, he said, oh, I spoke to my family. They said, forget the family, it was Jeanette he spoke to. There was no question about that. And she would always say he's not a quitter. She would see it as a means of, you know, we can't quit at this stage. You see, and I mean, it's not that other people haven't done that. I mean, remember Barbara Bush, the old George's wife? And she sort of adopted this grandmotherly white head. I mean, she was a tyrant. And every now and again, now it's coming out, but every now and again she'd slip and she'd say, when we were president.
I'm good, Inga. I just was wondering, concerning the present regime, would you say that Jeanette and John Howard are like Messalina and Claudius, or a little bit more like the Father, the Son and the Holy Ghost, John, Peter and Jeanette?
It's a bit hard. I don't think I can actually give you a pronouncement on that. I think I actually, you know, I can only go from my investigation, and I think I have to just say Bill and Hillary is as close as I could come to that.
Without Monica.
Yes, without Monica. That's the other thing, of course. I mean, everybody says to me, is it true that you had an affair with Brigau? Is it true that that's the reason Jeanette won't go to the lodge? I said, of course no, of course it isn't. I haven't met anybody who's prepared to give me even a hint of evidence that that's the case. And I think given the relationship I've described to you, I don't think the Prime Minister would be having an affair behind Jeanette's back. And I think the reason Jeanette likes Kira Billy is that she doesn't have to do any housework and nobody interferes with her.
And if you look out the window, why wouldn't you like Kira Billy?
Exactly. But, you know, if she was in the lodge, I mean, she was in the lodge, she'd have no privacy. I mean, they're coming and going, and it's a fairly small place. Margaret Whitlam said she felt like an ageing princess in a tower. And she said at one time she just found herself sitting up in her bedroom eating a dinner off a tray, thinking, you know, because the place was full of bureaucrats and politicians, and she thought, this is a terrible life.
Very
isolated,
yeah. Yeah.
Just from your, your interviews and that, have you got any sense of the profile these people may have elected to have after they've had their time in office? I think of someone like Sonia, who you see in the A-listing, hanging out in the eastern suburbs, you you see Tammy from time to time, but I don't know what she does.
She makes gardens and she runs the...
she's got a bit of a profile, hasn't she?
Yeah, a little bit. She does good works.
When you talk about Jeanette and you say that it's the biggest game in town, the only game in town, in the next stage of life, what is she going to do with herself? What's he going to do with himself?
I don't know, and I think he said he's worried about it because I did actually find a quote where she said, I might have married you for better or worse, but not for lunch. and he said he's going to play a lot of golf, which I think means he's going to be out of the house a lot. And so I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do because I honestly think it's been their major combined passion. And in fact, if you go to the old Parliament House, they've got this new thing, you see all the ex-prime ministers and they all have their portrait painted when they're finished, when they're no longer in office. What the portrait gallery in Old Parliament House has now done is ask John Howard as the first incumbent to have a portrait painted while he's in office, and he could choose the artist and choose himself like how he's portrayed. Now I would have thought, sitting at the SCG watching the cricket or something would have been good. He's chosen to be absolutely one figure with Jeanette, his arm around Jeanette, the two of them, Kira Billy in the background, and I think that says it all, in that he wouldn't have had any of this without her, and that they are united, hip to hip. So I don't know what they're going to do. I think they'll probably be quite miserable, really. I think why he's fighting so hard now.
He'll go off and change his house.
Yes.
The city's full of it.
Yes. He'll find an office and he'll probably find some things to do. And he'll have a life and she'll probably still monitor the media,
Yeah, but he, as a former Prime Minister, he will have an office. He will have staff. And there'll be plenty of people who want to talk to him.
Sure.
And
Wouldn't Howard write a book?
Probably. Okay, anything else? Are we all done? So, what's your next task?
Not a political biography. I've got a novel just about finished, which is a non-fiction novel, which does deal with social and political events, so that's fictionalised. And I have another biography in mind, but I can't tell you what it is. I mean, I'm writing it, but I can't tell you what it is yet. And believe me, it will not be published until the person is dead.
Okay, take the Susan Mitchell on again tonight. I found her analysis very insightful, actually, of three people, of my knowledge of them and my reading about them. So I thought that was very insightful. Anyway, it's all there in Stand By Your Man, and Janet Grundy's got some copies on the back. But for tonight, well done, and we'll see you back sometime in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.